get half a dozen sessions on this topic. You probably know that I spend a fair amount of my time around other countries, and I've been invited often to various places in Asia and Africa where people say, we want you to come and help us to know how we can understand the Bible and how we can teach the Bible to congregations. They realise it's a deficiency. The interesting thing is that in Australia, this is only the second time I've ever been asked to do what I've been asked to do overseas, probably 20 times. I don't know if there's a message in that, but in the course of doing these things in other countries, I put notes together and it expanded and it eventually came out in a book. Let the Bible speak for itself. Let the Bible do its own thing. Any of you who know anything about my ministry over the last 30 years will know that it's basically been, let the Bible loose. Open it up, explain it. The Bible is our tool for evangelism. The Bible is our tool for teaching. And I'm convinced that the best way to teach the Bible is by taking it in the form God gave it, namely in a collection of books. 66 books that look at first to be a rather miscellaneous collection, all sorts of shapes and sizes and styles, but that's the way God was pleased to reveal his truth to us. And I'm sure that as we take that word and teach it, we can evangelize, we can pastor, and we can help people to grow. Now, because I've done this thing quite a lot, you might think it tends to get stale, and I just go over the same stuff time and time again. Well, it doesn't really work like that, partly because my first session is always not talking about the Bible, but simply talking from the Bible. Let's make sure that we go home today with something that we have found from the Bible in just going through some exposition. Normally I would go through a chapter or a book, Old Testament, New Testament, but I always do something different. And that keeps me fresh, so that if I've done this thing dozens of times, I have never used the same introductory talk twice. And that introductory talk then becomes something of an example that we can use as we move through the other talks and refer back. It keeps my illustrations and references different, keeps me fresh. Because you can take any part of the Bible and illustrate the sorts of things I'm going to talk about from that part of the Bible, or from the different way of handling things. If you want to take notes, you can try, but I can assure you that you won't take much more than what is written in here. So to save yourself a lot of time, there are 14 chapters in this book, and most of the things I'll be saying, except what I'm saying in this opening talk and tailing off in the final talk, but the central four talks are in here. Now there's a lot more in here than what's in those four talks. There are 14 chapters here, but it goes through those considerations, how to teach the Bible, how to understand the Bible, and in a way that's going to help us to know what the Bible says and find out what we might learn from it. Normally that's $7.95. We've got it going for $5, flat rate $5 today, and I would hope that every person or family or couple can get one. And this is not just a sales pitch, this is because whatever I say is going to be of minimal benefit if you don't follow it up by pursuing some of the ideas and letting them go around in your mind a bit more and thinking over them, and you'll find that they're all dealt with here, some of them in greater length than what I can possibly handle today. And the combination of the talk and the book, I think, will give us some benefit from this all-day seminar. There are also other books available, more about that later on, but this is the book that we're really concerned about, and I hope you can get one. It's not only concerned with how to interpret the Bible, but how to teach the Bible to Christians. There's also a chapter on how to run a Bible teaching program in a church, and also a chapter on how to teach the Bible to non-Christians. I have no trouble teaching the Bible to non-Christians. I find most non-Christians, we go through Romans, Acts, whatever, and they seem to understand it fairly readily. It's Christians that you have trouble teaching the Bible to sometimes, but the non-Christians, I really find that they understand it fairly readily. The Bible is not really a difficult book. Now, don't get me wrong. Somebody said to me once, boy, you know how to cut the Bible down to size, don't you? Well, here's it being a bit facetious. I wouldn't ever think of doing a thing like that, of course. What he was trying to say was, you've sort of stripped it a bit of its mystique. And I think sometimes people read the Bible thinking they ought not to be able to understand it because this is the Word of God and we should not really be able to understand it because it's so high and lofty. Okay, it is high and lofty, it is the Word of God, and the truths within it are profound. The Word became flesh. You can spend a lifetime trying to explain that and trying to understand the implications. How can the Almighty, the Eternal One, how can this Eternal One, how can the Creator become one of His creatures? And you go round and round. And it's profound. It's beyond the capacity of the human mind to grasp all the implications of that. But the way it's presented is very straightforward. A virgin conceived and she gave birth to a son. He grew up in Nazareth and he did this and that and he died and rose again. What I'm saying is that we must not confuse the profundity of the truth of the Word with the simplicity of the way it's been presented. Because it was given originally to ordinary people. It wasn't given to academics and to theologians. It was given to ordinary people, many of them ill-educated by our standards, perhaps not literate enough to satisfy us. They were farmers and fishermen and local neighbourhood people living in Israel and other parts around the east of Europe and the west of Asia and the north of Africa. But they understood it. And Paul wrote letters and the prophets wrote books and the people understood them. Why don't we understand them? We can understand them, and God intended us to understand them. So the Bible was written intending that we should understand it and profit from it. So there's nothing unspiritual about reading the Bible and enjoying it and seeing that it makes sense and that we can learn from it. Not trying to put it through its hoops and make it do tricks, but simply let it do its own thing. Loose it and let it go. Let the Bible speak for itself. What I'm going to do now is just have one talk as some sort of introduction. Then, in the next session, there will be two talks on how to interpret the Bible. After lunch, there will be a bracket of two on how to teach the Bible. And the final session, well, we'll wait and see how things have gone in the previous five sessions as to what we exactly do in the final session. I'd like to wrap it up with a little bit more exposition that would tie together in an illustrative form some of the things we've done, but also I'd like an opportunity for questions. I'm going to ask that we don't have questions interrupting these initial sessions because experience has told that nearly all the questions that get thrown up in the first two or three sessions get answered along the way anyway. But if when we get to the end of the fifth session, we start our final session, you still find there are things that haven't yet been touched on or questions raised that want to be dealt with, then we'll have an open session in that final slot. I want to speak now on the church in Ephesus. If we could look, please, to Acts chapter 18, that's where we'll start. And I'm going to do something that is a little different from what I would normally do. Normally I would like to go through a book or a chapter or a couple of chapters and show how we can expound a chapter or a book or part of a book in 40 minutes. And get the message across and let the Bible do its own thing. Now this is a little different, but I think it will serve a good purpose because the things that I'm going to talk about are not applicable only to expounding a chapter or a book. Even if you were to do a topical subject, the same fundamental principles apply. What I want to do is to look at the history and growth and character of the church in Ephesus. This map that I drew has earned the envy of people in other countries that I visit, and they all want to get a copy, and I tell them it's not very difficult, all you do is get a bit of paper and a felt pen and you make it yourself. So that's all you do, just make it yourself, and you can fold that up and you can take it with you anywhere, it can fit into the lid of your suitcase, and that thing goes around the world with me. I put a bit of lamination and stiffening in it just to protect it because a previous version of this got rather chewed up in some countries. But there it is, that really covers the story of the Bible, and we ought to have a map with us so that people can locate where they are and what we're talking about. Anything you meet in the Bible will be covered by that map. You've got Western Asia, Abraham and the Noah and the Genesis stories and so forth. You've got Canaan, where they settled, Old Testament stories and the nations involved in the Old Testament story through to the time of Jesus, and then the expansion of the early church into Syria through Asia Minor, Greece, Italy, and that's it. And if you want to then concentrate on Israel, well, you've got a map that covers the Old Testament era, and then you've got a map that covers the New Testament era. And that can go with you anywhere. And if it's not stiff, then you can fold it up and even put it in your pocket and take it with you. We're in the era of Paul's journeys, which could, for convenience, are normally referred to as 1st, 2nd and 3rd. And where we start our story, it's towards the end of Paul's second missionary journey. Now, the first missionary journey, you remember, he started out from here, he went to Cyprus and around parts of Asia Minor and then came back. Second time, he went up through here again, finished up in the top of Asia Minor here, jumped across into the north of Greece, and he travelled around and planted churches in various places of Macedonia the north, Achaia the south, and he finished up down here, and that was the end of his second missionary journey almost. He wanted to go back to Jerusalem. On the way, he goes across here and stops on the west coast of Asia Minor at a place called Ephesus. That's where the story starts. We are in Acts chapter 18. He has just left Corinth in the south of Greece, and he comes to Ephesus. As we look at a few verses, I want you to notice the sorts of people that make up the church, the composition of the church as it grows. Now, at this stage, there is no church in Ephesus. This is the first time the gospel has come. So in chapter 18, after many days, in verse 18, Paul left Corinth. He took with him Priscilla and Aquila. And in verse 19, they came to Ephesus. Now, he left Priscilla and Aquila there. He himself went and argued in the synagogue for a while with the Jews, and they were inclined to listen to him. In fact, they said, "We'd like you to come and stay a bit longer." So they were quite receptive, which is a welcome change. So the first people we're meeting here are Jews from the synagogue who seem to be sympathetic to the message. Paul doesn't want to stay. He leaves Aquila and Priscilla behind, and he keeps moving because he wants to head back to Caesarea in verse 22 and eventually to the church in Antioch that he had come from. Now, in the meantime, back in Ephesus, a Jew from the north of Africa called Apollos, in verse 24, arrives. And now, you know a little bit about Apollos, I'm sure, that he was an eloquent man. He knew how to teach the Bible. He had the right approach. His delivery was attractive and people were turned on by him. But he was a bit deficient in his understanding of certain Christian truths, whereupon Aquila and Priscilla took him home and straightened him out. And the consequence was that Apollos became a better preacher. He didn't get offended because somebody showed him a better way. He learned from it. I hope you and I can learn from this. Sometimes somebody will point out something to us that we needed to know, and we get in a bit of a huff at times. Well, Apollos doesn't seem to have got into a huff. He benefited from it, and the result was that he became a better preacher. In due course, he decided he would go across to Corinth, and the Christians in Ephesus, they recommended him to the church and said, "I think you'll find he's a good chap." So off goes Apollos, and you notice in verse 27 that when he wished to cross over to the south of Greece, Achaia, the brethren, we now have a group of brethren there in Ephesus. We have the start of a church. Already there are sufficient of them put together to call themselves a recognisable group. So this is the start of the church. I should imagine that most of those early converts were people from the synagogue, Jews who were receptive to the message. So he goes across. Well, that's the end of Apollos as far as we're concerned, but at least it gives us a little bit more insight into what's happening in Ephesus. Now, while all that's happening, Paul has started on what we call his third missionary journey. And in chapter 19, verse 1, while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul passes through the upper country and he comes to Ephesus. So Paul has set out from Syria and he's come through Asia Minor and he now lands there in Ephesus and he stays there for 3 years. That is the longest that Paul stayed in any church that he planted, the longest initial period he spent anywhere. And so the church in Ephesus really started to grow. Now the next people added to the church we find are a bunch of disciples of John the Baptist, and they also had a belief of some sort but had a deficient understanding of Jesus and the Holy Spirit, whereupon Paul instructed them and they became better Christians, and so they get added to the church. But they've come from a bit of an unorthodox background, and so that adds a little bit to the colour of this growing church. You come to verse 8, and here Paul now enters the synagogue, and for 3 months he gets away with it. He's able to survive for 3 months in the synagogue, and people listen to him, he argues, he pleads, and more people become Christians. But some of the hardline Jews have got rather upset over all this, and in verse 9, the stubborn and disbelieving ones started to say nasty things, and they forced Paul out, and so he had to leave the synagogue, and he took the disciples with him, and he moved into a local hall that he rented called the Hall of Tyrannus. And for the next 2 years, he taught these disciples in the Hall of Tyrannus. And the result was that all the people in Asia heard the word. Asia is, of course, the western part of Asia Minor, just this province around here. Elsewhere we are told that Paul himself didn't visit the interior parts of Asia with the gospel. The churches that were planted in Colossae, Hierapolis, Laodicea, these were not planted by Paul, he tells us so. I imagine that they were planted by these zealous converts, these disciples. Everybody in Asia heard the word, but they didn't hear it from Paul, because Paul was there in Ephesus. So how did they hear it? Well, it seems to me they heard it as these disciples went out and took the message and planted it in population centres around that part of Asia Minor. And so the church expanded. And that went on for 2 years. So here you find that the church has a good bunch of zealots, people that are really fired up about evangelism and church planting and growth and all that sort of thing. So there's a pretty healthy element in the church that Paul has trained and utilised fairly well, and so off they've gone. But Ephesus also was a bit of an oddball place in that it tended to attract our people of various colours. And so you find in verse 13 that we have some itinerant Jewish exorcists. Now I should imagine that these fellows are a bit different from the normal Orthodox characters you'd meet in the synagogue. They go around and they earn a living through exorcising evil spirits and doing other spectacular things. Well, they come along to Ephesus and they see what Paul's doing, and you can read the story for yourself. They get a bit impressed. Some of them are really off on a tangent, and Paul's not too impressed with them. But some of them weren't all that bad, I guess. But you can see again that you have this bunch of very unorthodox Jews. If we've had orthodox Jews in the synagogue that are repenting and believing the gospel, you've got some very unorthodox ones that are running around doing fancy tricks. Now, in verse 17, we find that some of the unusual happenings that went on as a result of this activity became known to all the residents in Ephesus, both Jews and Greeks. Aha! So you can find now that we've got a cross-cultural thing going on here. We've got different ethnic groups, Jews, Greeks, Orthodox Jews, unorthodox Jews, weirdos, and so on. Down to verse 18, a lot of people that have been dabbling in the occult, and now that they get convicted, they think they better confess their secret sins. They become believers in verse 18, some of these fellows and women. They become believers, and now that they become believers, the word has started to penetrate here and there, and so they've snuck out and started to confess their secret practices. In fact, the movement grew, and soon you find in verse 19 that they made a bonfire in the middle of the town. They brought their magic arts, their books and all the stuff, and had a big celebration in the middle of the town by burning all the bits and pieces that went with their occult and other offbeat practices. Now, these are Christians in the church now, but they've come from a different background again. And some of them already brought their baggage with them and then got rid of it in stages when they became more convicted. Others may not have got rid of their baggage so quickly. But you can see that this church is starting to become a very colourful church. It'd be a very interesting church to work in, wouldn't it? Well, there's more to the story yet. You come down to verse 23, and there is a disturbance in the town, and it develops into a riot. And the reason is that so many Christians have been made, there are so many people have left their idolatry and become Christians, that the local craftsmen who make small idols of the deity, they're going out of business. And so they can't sell their wares, and in these sorts of countries, people who are in the paraphernalia of idolatry, they're in a pretty good thing, and it's a good way to make a living, and they're selling all this stuff at a great rate. But it's not selling very well now, because too many people are becoming Christians and getting rid of all their idolatrous gear. And as you know, this man leads a riot. And so he says, come on, Demetrius. He says, come on, let's do something. And the story rolls on to show that it took a bit of calming in order to get things back to some state of equilibrium. And in due course, Paul leaves. He'd spent 3 years there. Now there's the composition of your church in Ephesus. It's a fairly colourful place. Paul was worried about it. If you look at the two churches that gave Paul the most bother, they were Corinth and Ephesus. Now we all know that Corinth gave Paul a lot of hassles. People up to hanky-panky and doing all sorts of things they shouldn't be doing, and crawling into bed with the wrong person and shacking up with somebody down the street and then taking somebody else to court and having arguments over who was their favourite preacher and doing a lot of stupid things that really made it a bit of a worry. Now Paul might have realised from the composition of the church in Corinth and from the place where it was planted that it was likely to attract the problems of a certain type, but he stayed there longer than he'd stayed anywhere hitherto. He stayed 18 months. But when it comes to Ephesus, he stays twice as long. He stays 3 years. Twice as long as he had spent anywhere else. I think because Paul realised that this oddball bunch that he had in that church there were not going to be all that easy to control and to train and to teach as time went on. Because some of these things that are below the surface aren't as dead or as dormant as you might hope that they should be. And he saw troubles ahead. So at the end of his third journey, he spent that time in Ephesus, and he went round here into Greece, and then he came back on his way back to Jerusalem. But on his way back, he stopped off again to have a talk to the elders of the church in Ephesus. So he pulls up at Miletus, which wasn't very far away, in chapter 20, verse 17, and he calls the elders from the church in Ephesus. And they came to him, and he gave them a talk, and he said, now look, you fellas, he said, I spent a lot of time here, and he goes through recounting some of his experiences as he taught the church. He says in verse 27 that he did not shrink from declaring to them the whole counsel of God. Wide ranging. He didn't just concentrate on two or three favourite topics of interest to certain Christian preachers. He gave them the whole counsel of God. He wanted a broad base on which they could build their lives. There was a lot of sweat and tears went into it, as he says. And he calls upon them in verse 28, this is the leaders of the church, he says, take heed to yourselves and to the flock over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to care for the church of God, to feed it, and so on. Because I know, verse 29, and this is the crunch verse, I know that after my departure, fierce wolves are going to come in, and they're not going to spare the flock. But not only are they going to come in from outside, verse 30, they are going to arise also from among yourselves. And they're going to draw away disciples. He saw that there was going to be trouble in Ephesus, both from travelling preachers who brought their newfangled wisdom into the church, and from local people who went off doing crazy things. Therefore, remember verse 31, that for 3 years I didn't cease day or night to admonish you with tears, and so it goes on. All right, well that's the conclusion of Paul's present connection with the church in Ephesus. He goes back to Jerusalem. And you know what happened there? He got into trouble with the Jews, got captured, locked away, and eventually he was shipped off to Rome because he'd appealed to Caesar. He arrived in Rome, and he was there for 2 years. Now, during the course of his 2 years in Rome, that first imprisonment in Rome is what we normally refer to it as, he wrote a number of letters. We call these his prison letters, and among them are letters to Colossae and Ephesus, two cities in Asia Minor. The letters are similar. Colossians is more specific, and it addresses certain people and issues in the church in Colossae. The letter to the church in Ephesus is not so specific, and it appears that it was very likely a broader letter that covered certain problems that were common in that region. Now, if they were common in that region, they had spread at least as far as Colossae, because the same things are talked about in the letter to Colossians. Obviously, there were some widespread problems. Problems largely concerning Jesus Christ, who Jesus Christ was. There was an attempt around to mix local philosophy with Christian theology, and it came up with some distorted views of Christ. How can the Holy God have any sort of contact with evil people? How can spirit and matter mix? Therefore, this Jesus, how can he be fully God and fully human at the same time? And so they invented all sorts of theories as to how he might have been part God or part human, and it created enormous strife. Now Paul tackles this problem, and so he writes to the church in Ephesus and to the church in Colossae, and he also wrote to the church in Laodicea, he tells us, and he told them to swap their letters around and benefit from the wisdom that he'd passed on to other people. And even if the letter he sent to Ephesus that we have in our Bibles was part of a broader letter that went to other churches, at least one of them went to Ephesus. So Ephesus, again, was at the centre of this problem. It's happened. The things that Paul was worried about have now happened. The false teaching has arisen, and the church is messed up. And they have come in from outside, and they have arisen from among them, and now they are messing up the whole Christian doctrine. And so the book of Ephesians has to try and straighten out some of those problems. Paul didn't stay in jail forever. As we read, he was there for 2 years. Now, that's the end of the book of Luke, so you're not going to read anything more about Paul in the book of Luke. Luke's finished his book, and he sent it off to Uncle Theophilus, or the local governor, whoever he was. Theophilus apparently was some official, I should imagine, a provincial governor or something of that nature. And Luke had wanted to give him a trustworthy account of the origins of Christianity from the birth of its founder through the arrival of Paul in Rome. Paul's now in Rome, and so Luke finished his book and passes it on. But because Luke has finished his book, that doesn't mean to say that Paul drops dead. There's no connection between the two. Some people think that that's the end of New Testament history because the book of Acts is finished. History didn't stop as soon as Luke finished writing his book. Things kept on happening, people kept on living, and so it went on. And we gather from Paul's writings that he was released at the end of his 2-year imprisonment, which is what he anticipated. If you read the letters of his first imprisonment, you'll find that he was optimistic in all of those letters that he was going to be released. And apparently he was released, and he went on further journeys. Now, we pick up the bits and pieces of those journeys by reading the letters he wrote when he went on those journeys. And the letters he wrote appear to be 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Now, if you can go across to 1 Timothy, I'll show you what I'm talking about. 1 Timothy chapter 1. We have no idea of the chronological sequence or the exactitude of the details of where Paul went. But it seems that we can piece together at least some of the possibilities from the information he gives us in these letters. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 verse 3, he writes to Timothy and he says, "As I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus and charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine." Let me just stop here for a minute and give us a bit of background. It seems that what happened was this. Paul left Rome and he went to visit some of the churches, as he had done previously. He took with him Timothy and Titus and probably others. Luke also, I should imagine. Luke seems to have been with Paul for donkey's ages. Ever going back to the third missionary journey, it seems to me that Luke was with Paul probably right through to the end of his life. He always seems to be bobbing up in the story. They went on a ship and they visited various places. One of the places they visited was Crete. And Paul found that the churches in Crete were horribly mixed up, chaotic. There was no leadership. It was every man for himself, real schmozzle. And Paul couldn't stay forever because he knew that he was running out of time. So having done some good in helping the people there, he left Titus behind and said, "Okay, Titus, you sort things out, appoint leaders and get these characters back on the straight and narrow. I've got other things to do." I'll go on with Timothy, and he went on to Ephesus. And he stayed there for a while and helped the people to sort themselves out and do one or two things. He saw that the place also was in a mess. He said, "Look, I can't stay here forever. I've got other places to do. I want to visit Greece again. Churches all over the place that I want to help." So he left Timothy behind in Ephesus, so that Timothy could help straighten out the problems there. And then Paul pushed off up into the north and across into Macedonia. When he got into Macedonia, he thought he'd write a letter to these two outsiders that he'd left behind in Crete and Ephesus. And the letters we call Titus, that was written to Titus, and 1 Timothy, that was written to Timothy. The letters are very similar, as you'd well know, except that Titus is a truncated version, to some degree, of Timothy. And they're both dealing with the same problem, this problem of false teaching. So Paul has now, as we see in verse 3, he has left Ephesus, as he says, I've left you behind in Ephesus. I've got up to Macedonia. I exhorted you to fix up all these problems concerning false teaching, and now I'm writing to you to give you a bit of encouragement and a bit further advice and direction. Now let's look now at the problem that had developed in Ephesus. Verse 3, teaching different doctrine. Verse 4, tell these people not to occupy themselves with myths and endless genealogies which promote speculation rather than the divine training that is in faith. The purpose of our charge is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and sincere faith. Now that's what Bible teaching is all about. And all the things we're going to look about today, or the things we teach in relation to sorting out what's what in the Bible, somehow it's all got to come back to a few basics that we want to feed people, build up people, that love is central, purity of heart, rightness of motives, good conscience, and sincerity of faith. Now, if we're getting outside of those areas, we are soon going to find that our ministry becomes sterile, and before we know where we are, we'll be wandering off into fruitless pursuits, speculating over all sorts of things that are going to happen or haven't happened or might happen if you stitch together different verses from parts of the Bible. And people sometimes treat the Bible as if it's a book of conundrums or crossword puzzle or, you know, the sorts of things. People have enormous fun working out all sorts of mystical things and speculating on what's what. But it doesn't have much to do with love, doesn't have much to do with building up people in the faith, sincerity of conscience or whatever. And Paul says, that's what we want to aim at. And all these people have gone off at a tangent speculating over genealogies, the name of this name means such and such, and his father and his uncle was such and such, and his son was producing this and this, and they build all sorts of fanciful constructions around the meaning of names out of the Book of Chronicles or whatever they're working on. He said, it is not profitable, and it's not the way to handle the Bible anyway. So he goes on to say, verse 6, certain persons have swerved from these aims and ideals of verse 5. Certain persons have swerved from these, and they've wandered away into vain discussions, useless, meaningless, and all it does is create problems. He said they want to be teachers of the law in verse 7, but they don't understand what they're talking about, and they really are just a plaguing nuisance. If you go over chapter 4, he mentions it again. He said, now this is nothing new, because the Spirit told us that in the latter times people would depart from the faith and give heed to deceitful spirits. And so what you're seeing is the very thing that I warned you about. Doctrines of demons, for example. Verse 2, pretensions of liars whose consciences are seared. Hey, Paul really knows how to call a spade, doesn't he? No, nothing like, our dear brother has a slightly different opinion of something. Straight on the nose he hits them. Pretension of liars. Their consciences are seared. They forbid marriage. They enjoyed abstinence. They got a few little pet doctrines. You know, people have pet doctrines that you're not to get married, or you are to get married, or you get half married, or three quarters, or what. You know, people have got all these little thingos that they pursue. I heard a discussion somewhere in Brisbane recently. They were discussing a certain part of a certain book of the Bible. It was a round table discussion. And they asked one person what he thought of something, and he said, oh, he said, I don't know anything about that. The only book I know anything about is the book of Revelation. That was his thing. He knew all the bits and pieces and every nut and bolt and nook and cranny of the book of Revelation, and he was an expert on that. Incidentally, I'm sure he was not an expert on it. If he didn't know the rest of the Bible, you can just about bet your boots that he was way off beam on the book of Revelation. But you see, that was his thing. So people have their little party line stuff or their avenues of private pursuit, and these people have got pro-marriage, anti-marriage, pro-enjoyment, anti-enjoyment, and so Paul goes on and talks about it. Verse 7, have nothing to do with godless and silly myths. Train yourself in godliness. Oh, the amount of time you've got to waste dealing with nonsense and rubbish and troublemakers, it really is a bit annoying sometimes. Go over to chapter 6. Chapter 6. Well, here's another Pauline burst. A lovely, let your speech always be grace seasoned with salt. Well, I suppose the secret of understanding and using the Bible is to know where we apply different teachings. For every verse in the Bible that says one thing, if you shop around hard enough, you'll find a verse elsewhere in the Bible that says something else. Because everything is said to someone in a context. And there are some times when we are to be this way, and there are other times when we're to be quite something else. And part of the maturity and growth and discernment of Christianity is for us to know when to act in this way and when to act in that way. When is it better to draw back and go softly, and when are we to be uncompromising? Well, we've got no set answer for this one. You've just got to look upon that as part of our Christian growth and work them out as they go along. Verse 3. If anyone teaches other than what I've just been talking about here, doesn't agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that accords with godliness, he's puffed up with conceit, he knows nothing. He's got a morbid contriving for controversy, for disputes about words, which produce envy, dissension, slander, base suspicions, wrangling among men who are depraved in mind and bereft of the truth. This is real sort of fire from the belly stuff that Paul is giving here. But this is what happened in Ephesus. Now, he said it was going to happen. He could see it years earlier. He could see that some of the mixtures he had there, who were still carting into the church bits and pieces out of their background, he can say, I can see that after I go, people from among you are going to arise, other characters will come in from outside, they're going to mess up this church, and you elders are going to have a tough job keeping the place on the straight and narrow. And now it's all happened, so it goes on through 1 Timothy, and if we had time and inclination, we could look at 2 Timothy as well. Well, Paul eventually finishes that part of his missionary excursion, he goes back, and as you know, in 2 Timothy, he finally gets executed. But because Paul's executed, the church doesn't stop. Ephesus keeps on going, and you move on another decade, and you get into the AD 90s. And the place still has problems with false teaching. Now, on this occasion, it's the Apostle John. Now, John is probably the last surviving member of the original apostolic group. He's the most respected man in the church. He writes what we call the Gospel of John, and letters that we refer to as the Letters of John. We don't know exactly the time or place of their writing, but there are ample indications in other early church records to suggest that John was in Ephesus, and that was the hotbed of the false teaching that he has to grapple with in his gospel and his letters. Again, concerning the person of Christ, they are still mixed up over the person of Christ. They still have this Gnostic, docetic, these sort of aberrations and heresies and false teachings going on. How can this person be both God and man? And so John writes his gospel to show the sort of person Jesus was. And at the end of it, he says, now, I'm writing these things to you so that you may be convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and that believing you will have life in his name. Because there were some that were saying this person might be man, but he's not properly God. And John shows time and again through the whole book, from the first verse to the end, he says he is God, he is divine. But there were other people, false teachers, who had the opposite view, and they said, well, if he's fully God, he can't be fully man. He might have been pretending to be a man, he might have appeared to be a man, he might have been a superman, but to suggest that he was the same as the rest of us, that was blasphemous. They said, how can God be like one of us? And so they watered down the humanity of Christ. So on one hand, you've got the people watering down the deity of Christ, and John deals with that problem in his gospel. Those who water down the humanity of Christ, he deals with them in his first epistle. Those who deny that Christ has come in the flesh, he says that several times, they are antichrist, they are false teachers. And thankfully, he said, some of them have left the church, good riddance to bad rubbish. They went out from us because they were not of us, and the fact that they went showed they didn't hold to the apostolic truth, and I'm glad to be rid of them, says John, you know, 1 John chapter 2. And so there is the message of 1 John, and then you've got 2 and 3 John where you have the same problem cropping up. But you get the picture. Ephesus still has these problems. Problems that are similar to those dealt with back in the epistle of Paul to the Ephesians. Similar to those dealt with when Paul wrote to Timothy. And now they're still going 20 years later. John gets to the end of his days, and we flip over to Revelation. Revelation chapter 1. And John is now exiled on the Isle of Patmos. Now, there are some people who say that the John who's exiled on the Isle of Patmos is not the Apostle John, but some other person of the same name. I am of the persuasion that it is the same person, and that the John who had the revelation recorded in the last book of the Bible is the same John who wrote the Gospel and the Epistles. We won't stand here arguing the pros and cons of it right now, but whoever this person was, whether it's the same John or not, it doesn't affect what I'm going to say about Ephesus. Because this person, John, in verse 9, is exiled on the island of Patmos. Now, where's the island of Patmos? It's just here. This is Patmos, just off the coast from Ephesus. And there John receives this revelation, and he sends the revelation to seven churches. And the seven churches are all in the western part of the province of Asia. And the first church to which the message goes is Ephesus. And if you trace those seven letters, it seems that they are in a circle, and it seems that the reason they're listed in the order they're given is that that would have been the route that a messenger would have followed as he dropped the letters off in each of the seven churches, went round and came back to Ephesus at the end of the seventh, got on the boat and went back to Patmos and told John how the churches were faring. So he comes from Patmos across to Ephesus, and the first letter is the letter to Ephesus. Let's go to chapter 2. He says in verse 1, this is the letter to the church in Ephesus, and in verse 2 he says, I know your works, your toil and your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear evil men, but you have tested those who call themselves apostles but are not, and you found them to be false. It's still going on. Now here we are in the AD 90s. Paul established that church back in the AD 50s. And then in the AD 60s he revisited it. And then we've got the AD 90s. It's now four decades, just about. We've turned over a generation or more. And the church still has these problems. But the elders that Paul first instructed had passed it on, and they developed a characteristic of defending the truth against all these attacks from weird people. So he says, I know your patient endurance. You've put up with these characters for an awful long time now. You can't bear them. You've tested them. You found them to be false, and you've thumped them on the head. Verse 3, you are enduring patiently. You're bearing up for my name's sake. You've not grown weary. 10 out of 10 for endurance. Steel in your legs. That's what I like to see, says Paul. John, as the mouthpiece of Jesus. But, verse 4, I have this against you. You have abandoned the love you had at first. And the church is now hardly worth a cracker because it's lost its love. It's become hard and cold. Ooh, it's pretty good on what's truth, how they're going to follow the truth and get rid of all these people that are wrong. Okay, that's good that you pursue the truth and that you reject evil. But you've lost your first love. Now verse 5, remember from what you've fallen. Repent. Change. Do the works you did at first. Because if you don't, I'm going to come and remove your lampstand out of its place. I can't use a church where love has died. What's the point of having all this truth all sorted out in the little boxes and compartments and defending against inroads of modernism and everything else if you've got no love? If you've lost the vision. Remember at the beginning, this was a church with vision that went out and evangelized in the surrounding areas. But now they've lost all that because all they've become concerned with is standing for the truth. And that has consumed them. Love has gone out the door and the church will disappear because God doesn't have much use for a church or for Christians who've lost the fundamental characteristic of Christian love. What was the charge that Paul gave to Timothy? He says, remember this, our charge concerns love that issues from a pure heart, a good conscience and sincere faith. At the heart of it is love. At the heart of it is our concern, our pastoral relationships, our love for the Lord and our love for his people. So while we talk today about understanding the Bible and teaching the Bible, let's keep it all in perspective. We want to teach the truth. But let's not get off on a tangent by promoting speculation over endless genealogies and other things that lack the emphasis on the divine training that is in faith. And keep before us all at all times the aim of our charge to be love, issuing from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith. We'll stop there, and I think we have a break. And then when we come back, we'll start into our first session on understanding and interpreting the Bible.
The book, Let the Bible Speak for Itself, and other books by Don Fleming are available from Bridgeway Publications.